Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas, owner of many of Seattle's finest restaurants, including the Dahlia Lounge, Palace Kitchen, Etta's Seafood down there in the market. Man, Etta's is packed right now. That summertime crowd is awesome.
I bet it is.
Yep.
And I'm Thierry Rotureau, the chef in the hat, owner of Luc in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle.
Absolutely. We're a little lonely this week with no studio audience. We're recording the show in the large LARJ Media Studios here in Wallingford. Right around the corner, if you want to know where we are, we're right around the corner from the Art of the Table, Jewel Restaurant, Fremont Brewery, and Whale Winds. This is a little food mecca right here, a little micro food mecca right here in Seattle.
Great area, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Stoneway, and that's right down to the lake where Westward Ho is, or I guess it's not called Westward Ho, it's just called Westward.
Westward.
Yeah, I always think of that kind of cowboy, Westward Ho, you know, it's like on your horse and taken off along with Roy
on
Rogers.
The lake.
Yeah, exactly. We got a big show for you today. We're excited to be here. It's Brittany Bartleben's going to join us for the Baker's Corner. She's the pastry chef from the Dahlia Bakery and Dahlia Lounge. And once again, I make one little statement, and social media blows up on me. Is it good or is it bad on Cairo Radio? That's our iced tea. Should we just have a simple iced tea like oolong or green tea or English breakfast iced tea? Or do we need a fruity combo like passion fruit along with the tea? And I made a statement about what I preferred last week. And, of course, things blew up on it. And so we're going to have to talk about that a little bit. We're going to have a dinner party using eggs in every course.
Oh, good.
Really?
I love that.
An egg cocktail.
I love it.
Okay, good. You're on the cocktail. And we're going to have some fun kitchen hacks to share with you for your home cooking while you're in your home kitchen. It's always fun here. We have a two-hour show. We're here Saturday and Sunday, and we hope that you join us, whether it's live terrestrial radio or whether you go to our podcast and pick us up at your own convenience while you're hopefully manicuring your herb garden. Or you're driving safely down the road, or you're...
Or just having a simple barbecue at home.
Yeah, cooking low and slow on your barbecue out in the front while sipping on whiskey. Those are the kind of things that we picture in our heads that you're doing while we're chatting away here on the Seattle Kitchen Show. So, it's very exciting. Let's jump right into Ordinary to Extraordinary. Tina Knoll, our producer, is going to lay out a few questions for us, huh?
Yeah, so... I decided this week that we would turn cocktails from ordinary to extraordinary. We play this game every week where I give you an ordinary dish like mac and cheese or spaghetti or something, and you guys add your chefy culinary brilliance to it and turn them from ordinary to extraordinary. So today, our cocktail version of the game, we're going to start with the strawberry daiquiri.
I love a strawberry daiquiri.
Yeah. I haven't had a strawberry daiquiri since like college, I think.
And what goes better with strawberry than basil? Just go in the pot in the front, and I'm talking about my house now.
Go on.
Go in the pot in the front, get a few slices of, cut a few pieces of basil, bring them in, and then the first thing I would do is muddle it into the bowl, into the shaker, and then put the rest of all the liquids into that after it's been broken down. It will macerate instantly. You shake it really good, and you have a wonderful strawberry daiquiri. And, of course, put a little tiny heads of basil right on top of that drink, and then eat it as you drink your strawberry daiquiri.
Eat it as you drink it. The only other thing I would add to that, you know, anise hyssop would be perfect for that,
I was going to keep it for another one.
And also, just try to use local berries. I mean, try to really find and seek out local berries.
Skagit Valley strawberry, they've been around, and they are fantastic this year.
Exactly.
So fresh strawberries, basil, and maybe even some anise hyssop.
You said anise hyssop. So people have asked about that?
People have asked about that.
And what do they want to know?
Well, A, how do you spell it?
Okay.
And B.
A-N-I-S-E. H-Y-S-S-O-P. H-I or H-Y? H-Y-S-S-O-P.
And where does one get to that?
Well, just go to a nursery and buy a plant. It grows very easily, like parsley or cilantro and basil. And they're all easy growers. You just have to keep them out of total direct sunlight, or else it'll bolt on you like any of those things will do.
Mm-hmm. Like cilantro.
And, just so you know, it reseeds itself. I have some in my front patio. Every year it reseeds itself, and the reseed is really beautiful and strong.
Mm.
For some reason, it seems like the reseeding is stronger than the actual
product. And what is the flavor? What is that doing in your daiquiri or in your food? What's the flavor there?
I would say it's a cross between fennel and tarragon.
And a little hint of mint.
A little hint of mint, yeah.
You know, when you go in your garden, you look at the herbs. Anything that's a square stem is part of the mint family. So you will always have a mint hint from a square stem.
You guys, learn something new. Learn something new every day. I love it. All right. That is definitely a way to make a strawberry daiquiri delicious. All right. How about the mojito? Speaking of mint.
Oh, wow.
Whoa.
How do you make a mojito better? Well, you slice some cucumber and muddle that with it?
With the mint?
Yeah.
I
love cucumber water because I think it's such a beautiful. But in a mojito, it might actually disappear a little bit.
Boy, I don't know how to make it better other than buying better rum.
Yeah,
and you know, maybe trying a spiced rum in there instead of the plain rum or añejo rum. You know, just that stuff that's been aged in oak a little bit.
You could definitely take the blossom of the anise isop we just talked about, which is a purple little blossom, and then break it down on top of your mojito. And you know, every time you take a drink of your mojito, you'll have a little anise mint flavor in the background.
Yum! So. Use maybe a more unique type of rum and then add some other flavors. Do we have time for one more?
Yes.
Oh, Bloody Mary.
Well, Tom.
My favorite thing.
Your favorite thing in the world.
Well, it's not my favorite thing in the world. I don't drink Bloody Marys ever, shockingly. But on an airplane, I crave that Bloody Mary juice mix. I don't ever drink it with vodka or gin or any alcohol on the airplane. But in the morning, when I'm having a morning flight somewhere, I always order the Bloody Mary mix on the rocks with a fresh squeeze of lime. I don't know why. I don't drink it anytime, any place else.
There's a bartender in the back shaking.
Right.
You don't need to shake anything. Yeah. It comes right out of a Mr. and Mrs. tea can. You know, it's not even something that's super interesting. But for me, it's like a trigger. The getting on the plane, I just start to crave a little Bloody Mary mix on the rocks. I think it's because I don't eat breakfast and it feels filling to me compared to, say, a cup of coffee.
And it's savory, so you know.
Yeah, and it's savory, yeah. And much, much, much better to me than canned tomato juice.
Yeah.
Which I can't
even though it's probably the same thing.
Well, it is, but it's just not spiced, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, up next, we're going to use eggs in every course for a dinner party, and I just want to know who we're inviting. Who is the master
Some
of
celebrity.
The egg?
We'll think about it.
I'll think of one. I know one, a French guy.
Me too. It was Jacques Pepin.
Oh, that's so funny. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back in the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's Tom Douglas.
And Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
Hey, chef, I have one question to ask you.
Yes.
How exactly would you like your eggs at a dinner party, and who should we invite? I think before we did this on our last tease out, we both actually, without talking to each other, had the same guy in mind. Why is that?
Because when I think eggs, I think omelette. When I think perfect omelette, there's only two things that comes to mind instantly. One is Jacques Pepin and Julia Child, of course, making an omelette on TV. And the other one is in a section of a movie called Tampopo. There's a bomb that comes into a restaurant kitchen in the middle of the night, and all you see is his hand making that omelette. And that scene is, like, hilarious because you know how they do on TV. They take from the face, and then they go down to the hands, and it's not necessarily the same person. But whoever's making that omelette is a chef because he's tapping gently like this on the handle, and the omelette turns, and he puts it on the plate. This is like a bomb who went into a restaurant. It's really hilarious. That scene is fabulous. But anyway, that's what I think when I think of eggs. Always first thing in my head is Julia Child, Jacques Pepin, the classic of making a French omelette.
That's what I think of, is the French omelette, because that's not something I had ever made until I saw him do it.
Oh.
I've always made that kind of West Coast saute house folded omelette, you know, where you it's like of shaped scrambled eggs.
Right, right.
And then you have it's like a pancake, and you fill it with your filling, and then you roll it over and fold it.
Yeah.
Whereas Jacques making the little stirred omelet, really stirring vigorously, and so that it's just kind of this soft kind of baby poop texture of eggs, where it never really firms up.
It's called runny, not baby
runny.
Poop.
Well, it's the same idea, but it never really firms up.
Correct.
And then you do what with that?
Then you fold it, and then
you fold that too.
You put a little cheese, if you want cheese in your omelette. You put a little cheese, grated cheese in there. You fold it, and then actually fresh herbs too, mm-hmm. if you want chives usually. Fold the whole thing up and then put it on the plate. So when your omelette falls onto your plate, it should be in the shape of kind of like what look like upside-down lips, kind mm-hmm. of like, or half moon. And it should be a little bit runny. There should be a little oozing coming out of the mm-hmm. of the eggs. Mm-hmm. That's a perfectly cooked omelette. Don't forget then, you know, people make that mistake. Like we often say that, Tom, is things keeps on cooking.
Yeah.
So eggs cook really instantly fast. I mean, the contact with heat makes them cook. So if you put them in a pan, if you put them in a plate folded and still hot, it will keep on cooking. So by the time you're halfway through your omelet, I mean, it is totally perfectly cooked.
Okay, so we might have to skip the dinner and just have this omelet discussion because here's what you just said to me. You take it off the fire while it's still runny and undercooked. And so now you're telling me that after I eat half of it undercooked, then the second half is perfect.
No, the
second half. Because it keeps cooking.
What I'm saying is it won't be overcooked because if you cook your omelet all the way.
Is the first half undercooked?
No, it's just if the whole thing stays perfect because. Well, with the first half is slightly undercooked. You have to have an omelette that is slightly undercooked in order to have the whole omelette been perfect all the way through. Does it make sense?
No, it does not make sense, but that's okay. But here's the thing I'll say about that is I never ate omelettes. I didn't like them mm-hmm. because so many people made them runny, and I just found them kind of gross, and
right.
I just didn't like it. And then I was at a little bistro outside the Louvre, and I had my first omelet, like in one of those outside cafes, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I ordered the goat cheese omelet with fine herb.
Right.
Right, which is
classic.
Like soft herbs, classic. It's on every right. bistro menu.
And side note, the goat cheese helps keep the omelet moist. Because
fine. So that means you can actually cook the eggs.
Correct. You can cook it a little bit more.
Yeah. And what I loved about that omelet, the other thing I don't like about American omelets so much, even the ones we serve in our restaurants, because it's the style that people like,
right.
is that it was fully browned a little bit on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this omelet, which I never order. I don't know why I did. It just felt right. So I ordered this goat cheese omelet with fine herb, and it came out almost the size of my plate. It was a big omelet, which I don't think of in France of getting big portions.
Right.
So it was more than I could eat. It was unbelievably perfect. And I have been eating omelets like that ever since. And to this day, some 25 years later, that fine herb and goat cheese fresh chèvre mm-hmm. omelet is my favorite omelet of all time.
Yeah.
And it is just a wonderful thing. But I just have to disagree with you a little bit on the whole, you know, eating half of it undercooked, which makes the other half perfect, is a problem for me.
Correct. It's not said correctly. I just love my omelet not to be cooked all
the way. Yes.
I just can't stand.
But eggs. To me, you wouldn't like it hard on the second half. You want it undercooked the whole way.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. I don't want it to be cooked all the way, which is why I'm much more on the undercooked than on the overcooked side.
Right. And it's why when I get my eggs fried, I always ask for over medium instead of over easy because I like the white set.
Right.
You know, and I don't necessarily like the yolks runny, but I'm fine with them runny. But it's just funny, the little technical difference. Okay, so we're having a dinner party, and we've invited Jacques Pepin. And let's invite Julia. You know, on August 15th, I want to say it's Julia Child's 105th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
We're having a celebration at the Hot Stove Society.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's going to be a walk-around kind of tasting. And there'll be 10 recipes from her book, From Julia Child's Kitchen, which is in the past when we've done her birthday, we've always done Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Right.
This time it's from this new book, so it'll be new recipes. And just in reading the book yesterday when I was writing the menu, what a treasure she was. Every time. You know, this book is actually based around her TV series,
mm-hmm.
but what a treasure. It's just delightful to read and to, I because I knew her and I've had meals with her and all that kind of stuff, when I read the recipe, I literally am listening to her kind of sing-song it in my ear.
Well, you feel like you're with her in the kitchen. And
absolutely.
It's almost like grandma is talking and you're listening and you go, oh, okay, that's cool.
Yeah, and if you watched her on TV all the time, you could absolutely envision and hear her talk to you personally as you read this book, because she is so detailed in every part of the recipe.
These recipes,
they're 3 and 4 pages long, and yet they're simple recipes. It's just that her descriptions are so clear. It's crazy.
She was unbelievable. Yeah. The grand dame, for sure. For sure, grand dame.
All right, if you are making Jacques and Julia, we have 2 minutes. If you're making Jacques and Julia an egg entree, that isn't an omelet.
Well, I would probably go with quiche because I know those guys would mm-hmm. be.
I would go with souffle.
Yeah, souffle would be the dessert. Souffle. I would do it for dessert, but for entree.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I would definitely do a quiche or something of that nature. I mean, besides an omelette, because in French we eat omelette for dinner. So,
mm-hmm.
But I would make a quiche, a nice, beautiful ham and cheese quiche. Quiche Lorraine classic. Dice the ham, dice the cheese, Comté, you know, usually it's a good cheese to do, and small dice. And then I like to add a little caramelized onion. That's not really in the recipe, but mm-hmm. I like to add a little caramelized onion. Have your pâte brisée dough blind baked, so you
fully
pre-baked yeah. all the way. Brush a little leg wash on the bottom. Put your whole batter in there. And then first put all your ingredients in there with a little chopped chives. Then put all your liquid batter in there. Put it in the oven, 300 degrees, and let it cook. You do not want it to boil or to get too hot because it will souffle. But other than that, that's the only thing you have to watch. Make sure you put a sheet pan underneath your quiche when you cook it. So in any case of bad luck and it drips, it won't be. You won't have to clean your oven.
Do you remember what Chef Brittany Bartleben said a couple of weeks ago about how to make sure your crust that has been docked, right, has been right. poked, but how to make sure it doesn't leak?
Yeah, just take some egg white and brush them. I'm the one who told her that.
Oh, you told her yeah. that. Yeah, so when it comes out of the oven hot, that's when you want to put your egg white on because
Correct.
It'll cook into those little holes.
It will glue all the hole.
Yeah, exactly.
And it would be normally should have no leak left.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, so then we're going to have a Grand Marnier souffle.
Oh, classic.
Classic.
Mon Dieu, right. mon Dieu, c'est fantastique.
Was that Jacques or was that Julia?
Well, that's Julia.
One of my favorite Julia quotes is, I loved cooking with wine, and sometimes I put a little in the food. We'll be right back and check in on the food and the news on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen at the Large Media Studios here in Wallingford. We miss you guys. We miss our live audience back at the Hot Stove Society.
Boy, do I miss them, me. Usually I'm training them to clap, and it's missing today.
I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
Thank you for joining us. I hope you're in the garden right now. That sounds so delicious. Picking something for dinner. We have some questions from you, our trusty listeners. Also, we have some news updates. One not so good for me, anyway, because we're just have transitioned from the comment period on the Pebble Mine. As you know, I've been fighting this for many, many years. You have too.
Yeah.
And it's the proposed largest copper and gold, open pit copper and gold mine in the world in the headwaters of Bristol Bay, which is the last great salmon run left on Earth. And so it is just something that would devastate the population of the fish if something were to go wrong at the mine. And as we all know, mines break. And so
everything breaks.
In order to get that those precious gold and copper out of the ground, you have to use toxic chemicals, and it creates toxic waste, and that's what has to be somehow or another contained for eternity. And it is that's a difficult thing to do. Easy for somebody who lives 80 years to say, "Oh yeah, this is going to last forever," but as we've seen in British Columbia and down in Brazil, mines break and create havoc. And out there in the middle of nowhere, it's just unstoppable.
Right.
So the comment period ended July 1st. We now go into the Corps of Engineers has to go through and address the comments. We know that this current administration is all for this mine, so it's going to be hard to stop at this point. I don't know where to head right now. I'm at a bit of a loss and somewhat sad about the whole thing. Anything new? And you had your
we just had Bastille Day.
Yeah.
That was a wonderful celebration in Madison Valley, right in the back of Luke. We closed the street and have this big long table. We had a band playing beautiful tango music, and we had food and wine. We had a full buffet and bar and wine and rosé pouring everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We had, thank God, we had backup of rosé because we ran out of for the first rosé very quickly. it was a beautiful fête. And every year we do this on Bastille Day. We close the street and do a party. And it is what I wish I could do every weekend on that street. Every weekend in the summer should be closed and have the community come in and even do a potluck or something mm-hmm. of some kind. You know, it's like, just so people get together, because people have a great time. They talk to strangers everywhere. They sit next to other people they don't know and then have a great time, and then end up with a bottle of wine or whatever. have a good time, you know, and that's what it's all about. And the kids are running around, and it's fun.
And you're out there on a grill grilling mustard-coated chicken and sausages, is my guess.
That's right, on my Weber. No sausages, just chicken.
You cook all that on a Weber?
Well, not all of it. No, that would be a lie. My Weber is only 24 inches.
I know.
No. We have some pre-cooked in the kitchen. Obviously, we do cooking in the kitchen as well. But I cook a good bunch on the grill, and it's fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
So question, you had some questions from our listeners on our Facebook page.
Yes, our listeners are very active, chatting with one another and asking you guys questions. If you want to join the conversation, just search for Seattle Kitchen on any of your social media channels. Your first question comes from Daryl Ray. He asks, what is a great cooking set that will last? I cook 3 to 4 times a week. He's looking for some suggestions.
Well, you need to have a good sauté pan. You need to have a good pot to put water in it and boil stuff in. And then you need to have some kind of a grill. So it could be an iron grill that you put on your burners, or it could be a barbecue outside. But I think those three items would be a great stock, you know. A sauté pan, a boiling pot,
and I think
a grill.
I would guess, though, he's asking for a brand name of a line of pans that will last. He's a heavy cook. And I'll just say off the top of my head, I use two kinds. I use KitchenAid at the hot stove, which gets used all the time. Mm-hmm. There are sponsors at the hot stove. Let me be clear about that. But I've enjoyed their pans. They work great.
Right.
I've always used in the restaurants over the years, All-Clad.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, at some place like the Palace Kitchen, I will use a single pan in a night as much as many people will use in a year.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
When you do, let's just say we had 400 diners in last night. Each mm-hmm. diner on average takes, I will say, 3 pans?
Yeah.
2 to 3 pans?
Yeah.
Yeah? Times 400 people, that's 1,200.
Usage.
That's 1,600 times uses of that pan, and it gets washed each time. It gets on a twice as hot a burner as you have at your home kitchen each time.
Mm-hmm.
And so each time that pan is used, is maybe used 40 or 50 times a night.
Right.
Because I only have 40 or 50 pans, right?
Yes.
So just to be clear, they last beautifully. Some of those pans last 20 years in a kitchen, commercial kitchen environment.
Yeah. I've had some pans since the first beginning of our ovens.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're still in my kitchen.
You know, I do have one little tip when it comes to buying pots and pans and things in the kitchen. I have found, this is going to sound weird, but the Goodwill is a really amazing place to find really good pots and pans and like kitchen gadgets and things like that. The one in Ballard is chock full of stuff because that neighborhood obviously is a little affluent and people get rid of really good things there. So
you can
change them up, right? So it's a good way to like test out a few things for really inexpensive.
Yeah, and I would definitely concentrate on the thickness of your sauté pan. Make sure that you have a stainless steel pan that is really conducting heat and keeping heat. You know, cast iron, stainless steel, those are great pans. Easy to clean. You know, I mean, I would recommend that. So.
Okay.
All right, Tom, recently, or actually on our last episode of Seattle Kitchen, you took to task iced tea.
Oh, no.
You're pretty adamant about the reality.
I am just not allowed to have a bad opinion, I think.
The last time this happened, what was it, the cheeseburger, the taco?
I think it was either banana split or cottage cheese.
Oh, the banana split was very controversial.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. For the record, you mm-hmm. do not endorse the banana split.
For the record, everyone else does.
Right. Well, iced tea, we did a poll about iced tea. 89% of the people polled say they like just their iced tea, baby. No sugar, no nothing.
Ooh.
Which they do agree with you, right?
That's the first.
That was only part of my hate of, I hate the kind of passion fruity, you know, you're forced to drink these kind of tropical iced teas. That's what I hate. I like a good, like, English breakfast iced tea. I'd rather make a cup of hot tea and pour it over ice, you know, like from a tea bag, than some of these other crazy.
What if they didn't call it they just called it fruity water?
Yeah, agree or disagree with
that? Yeah, so 11% of our listeners say the fruitier, the better. But you know, Mandy.
So I won. So people liked.
You kind of won.
What do you mean?
Mandy's a little upset with you. She says that you should diversify your palate when it comes to tea. Maybe add some lemon, sweeten it a little. She likes it with some hibiscus in her black tea.
I must say that hibiscus is a good iced tea.
Everybody like says that. You have to add lemon.
I don't mind a lemon wedge or something like that. I'm talking about these kind of, you know, anyway.
And
so
James
people
Duncan
agree with
says,
me generally.
Yeah, most people do agree with you. James Duncan says just call it sweet tea and then get over it.
No. I do not do sweet tea.
No.
And it's not, you know, even sweet tea generally is a regular tea, like a Lipton black tea.
Right,
or something.
Right.
Even that starts there. But then they pour in cups of sugar and to make it sweet tea. And that's just not for me. I just don't enjoy that kind of...
I'm the same way. I don't feel like it's cutting my thirst when I have a lot of sugar in something.
But at least it's black tea.
Right.
If you want to weigh in on our poll, there's still a few days left. So hit
finally, I win one.
Yeah. People like you for a change. All right. I have a question here from Colleen.
That
Nicolette.
Was mean.
People love you.
That
Everybody
was mean.
Loves you. I love you. There's a lot of love in the room. Let's carry on. Colette Nicolette has a question for you on our Facebook page. She says she just got a pizza oven and wonders, does she really need 00 flour to make dough?
No.
And where can you get it? What is that? And what's
it's a low gluten flour, and it's but we actually use high gluten flour at Serious Pie, so we
know it is so good. That's my favorite pie, hands down. I go there literally a couple times a month, and now that I'm plant based, I just have them take the cheese off, and they do it for me. They're so great, and they put a little arugula on there for me because that dough is. Like that dough and that sauce, hands down.
That's
like,
high gluten flour. And so it's just a difference in style that you either like or don't like. So all these, like Napolitan. Napolitan pizzerias, they use 00, and that's where that's where she's getting that information from.
And so what's
it's just
zero,
a difference
zero
in style.
Do? Is it like make it's it denser, lighter?
Lighter.
Okay.
Lighter.
Okay. So try it or not. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. And I looked it up. You can get it on Amazon if you need to. I'm sure you can get it other places.
Yeah.
Is there anything you cannot get on Amazon?
I mean, really.
You know what I did get on Amazon the other day that I kind of liked out at the farm, and it works beautifully? A log splitter.
Oh.
Who knew I needed a log splitter? But, you know, I have a big pizza oven out there. I don't know if this young lady's pizza oven is wood-fired or not, because that is how I like a pizza oven. But I have a pizza oven out there, and I had all these. I took down a big walnut tree and a big cherry tree and a big apricot tree. So I have all these logs.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, well, you're 60 now, and that big axe looks like it's going to cut your foot off. So I thought, I'll just buy a little electric log splitter, and, man, it works good. I love it. And I just stand there. I push a button.
And the glass of rose.
I push a button and split the log. Okay. Up next, some from the New York Times, 15 helpful words for talking about wine. You need 15 words to talk about wine. You should drink beer. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're on Cairo Radio, and I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And we were looking at the New York Times article on 15 helpful words for talking about wine by Eric Asimov, which is the July 15th newspaper. And, you know, it made me roll my eyes when I first saw this article. And here's this is my favorite part about me rolling my eyes. Here is a practical lexicon that helps to describe the elusive characteristics of wine without eliciting eye rolls and forehead slaps. So the first thing I did was roll my eyes, even from this article that's supposed to make me stop doing that.
Right.
So, Mr. Terry, I almost called you T. Are there words that kind of crack you up when people talk about wine or just make you think, what does that mean? You know.
Well, there are definitely some word in wine that have been used in front of me, and I would look at them and go, really, how do you get that?
Yeah.
Because I have a decent nose, but to me, first of all, it's just like food. Do you enjoy it or do you not enjoy it? And that's where the confusion gets in. It doesn't matter what every expert in the world says. If you don't like the wine, you don't like the wine. You know, words that I love are, for example, I'm a big fan of the minerality in Sancerre and Sauvignon Blanc from the Loire Valley. That would be one word that I would use. I love that mineral because it's that dry chalkiness. It's kind of like if you imagine taking a piece of chalk and put it in your mouth and then take it out. It's so dry, right? That's usually reflect.
That's just what I want to think about when I'm drinking wine.
No, but that's one of the components. You know, it's and that's how what happens is once you start drinking wine, just like when you start eating different kind of food, just like you have a very diversified glossary of knowledge because you know you've tried so many different kind of food. You know, you're going to talk some food with some people, especially if you start talking about Asian food, for example. Mm-hmm. Some people are going to look at you and have no idea what you're talking about.
Right. A term we use in food a lot is like umami, right?
Right,
or
right.
Unctuousness. Or when something's kind of stinky.
A sauce that you use a lot, you know, in Vietnamese cooking or whatever.
Wok cham.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
People are going to look at you and go, what is that?
Yeah.
So it's the same concept in wine. You know, if you listen to people who actually have a very broad knowledge and really deep knowledge, you're going to be lost in the conversation. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's good to have a description of what you like, but it's not the most important part. The most important part is to find what you like.
I'd say the number one word I heard that I hear when people are drinking wine that makes me kind of either slap my forehead or go, oh, God, you know, it's smooth.
Yeah.
The word smooth. And you hear that when people talk about whiskey, too, right? When it
right.
doesn't burn the back of your throat. Or,
right.
But when people say a wine is smooth, I'm just not sure what to make out of that.
Right.
Does that mean it's got lots of tannins? Or does that mean it's velvety?
Yeah.
With
it's not a real
description. It's got big legs. You know, it's thick. Whereas other words, like it's fruity,
right.
as, you know, people say all the time.
Yeah.
Or sweet make much more sense to me than smooth. So,
well, the thing is that it makes sense to you, but the person who's actually saying it is probably believing what they're saying because that's what they're experiencing.
Right.
So the person who's been trying very, let's say you just started drinking wine a couple of years ago and you're in the, you know, $12 to $14 bracket of bottle of wine and you say it's smooth, it's different than the person who's going to be buying a $25 bottle of wine. And not because of the price, but because of the standard of, you know, the depth of the wine usually goes higher with the prices.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to have a lot more to talk about. And if the knowledge is bigger, the expression is going to be much bigger. So
I'm going to throw out some words that Eric Asimov has decided are helpful and not head-slapping to somebody who doesn't really drink a lot of wine. That this is a helpful description. Okay, he says, energetic. It's the first word that he throws out as a clearer way to talk about a wine.
That's the last thing that would come to my mind about a wine is to call it energetic.
Can a wine have energy? Absolutely. The quality is hard to describe, but it feels propulsive. This is, again, these are words that are supposed to make you not roll your eyes. It partly concerns texture, how the wine feels in the mouth, but it connotes liveliness as well. I mean, he goes on for another whole paragraph.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think this is coming from a wine guy, not from
I've never
guy
used
who doesn't
that
drink wine.
Word to describe wine. Okay, another one, tense. A tense wine feels as if it walks a tightrope between forces that threaten to pull it one way or the other, but are well balanced, and the wine never loses its footing. A tense wine can be thrilling.
Now, when I read this, I'm sorry. Tom, when I read the...
My eyes just rolled in the back of my head.
Me too. I've drank a million bottles of wine. Not a million, no, that's a lie. But I've drank a lot of wine in my life, and some very incredible wine.
You never thought about it that way.
Never thought about
he
it.
He uses, say, a sweet German Rieslings are classic tense wines. All right, plush. This goes a little bit back to the word smooth, right?
Correct. Plush, to me, for wine... I think the person is trying to describe how the mouthfeel is and trying to describe that kind of roundness, like
or
you said,
richness.
Richness into the mouth. So I can see that, for example, if you take a Syrah, you know, especially if it has just a few years of age on it, so you won't feel the tannin right off the bat. You'll feel the fruitiness and the, you know, the roundness, the robustness of that wine. So, yeah, I can see how you could use the word plush, but...
He uses other related words like opulent, fleshy, and velvety. And again, going back to that word that made me nuts, smooth, I guess if you just used the word plush, I wouldn't roll my eyes at you.
Correct.
Lean. That, to me, is a good descriptor.
I've used that.
Yeah.
I've used that. I think it's lean is when you have a wine, to me, that is very much one-sided in terms of flavor. Like, for example, if you take a very, very dry Sauvignon Blanc, for example. Or not a Sauvignon Blanc. More like a Grüner Veltliner. And it's very much, it can be very much one-sided in terms of in your mouthfeel. So I would call it, if I drink it, I would say, oh, I love this, it's lean. Or Muscadet, for example, the region where I'm from. They make very lean wine.
Very light wines, yes.
This lean in the way that it's not full of different angles of flavor. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much one-sided.
Yeah. Another word he used, which made me slap my forehead, linearity. I didn't even know what it meant in the beginning. I figured it out.
Bless
you. Yeah, exactly. Linearity means a well-structured wine with flavors that arrive in a smooth procession, maybe called linear. Linear wines have the potential for complexity as the flavors can change and evolve as they linger in your mouth. Other words that make sense to me, depth.
So far, we're 3-2-1.
I know. Depth, focus, where, you know, you can really focus on a grape varietal. Power, we all know that that's generally a wine's alcohol content. Precision, I'm not sure. Life. Some good wines can feel alive in the glass. This wine has life. I don't get it. Sweet is obvious. Savory, well, maybe it's got a black pepperiness like a lot of Chateauneuf du Pape has.
I can see how you would call a wine savory.
Yeah.
Like Oregon Pinot Noir usually have a good strawberry, kind of like a light hint of strawberry and spices in the back. You could say it's a bit of a savory wine.
And sometimes with that strawberry essence, people confuse that with sweetness when it's really just fruitiness.
It's just
there's no residual sugar at all.
Correct.
Right.
It's just flavor, not... it's not a sweetness, exactly.
Well, just to wrap this up, it is interesting how when a wine guy writes words that he thinks won't make you roll your eyes or slap your forehead, how when two guys who drink wine every day think half of his words are just that. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Mm-hmm. I think wine are meant to be drunk. Most importantly, they're meant to be enjoyed. And sometimes the simplest bottle of wine in the world doesn't need a description. It just needs good company.
Right. Or an ice cube.
Yeah.
Like a great bottle of, great bottle of rosé. All right. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Coming up, kitchen hacks, tips you can use in your very own home kitchen on Cairo Radio. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
Thanks for hanging with us during the long break. We got still one full hour to go. We're wide open eats. Some little thoughts about how to accomplish easy kitchen task that maybe we could do show you in a little bit better way.
Mm-hmm.
Food for thought. Tasty trivia is going to wrap up our show. Chef Brittany Bartolome is going to be here to talk about s'mores. I'm going to actually go to the bakery and interview her at the bakery, and we're going to make s'mores together.
Good.
I'm very excited about that. We were making
and
them.
After that, you should come to Luc and try our s'mores at Luc and the one at Lule and try our s'mores.
All right.
Both restaurants have one on the dessert menu.
Brittany and I were on the sidewalks of Fifth Avenue in downtown Seattle last week making s'mores over a Weber grill for about 100 people at a party that was happening in the ballroom.
Nice.
We were standing out front, and I was her grill man. I was grilling the marshmallows, the anise of marshmallows, and we used Theo chocolate root beer chocolate bars, and they have little ground-up pieces of hard root beer candy in the chocolate bar.
What?
And then homemade graham crackers, which I think is what we're going to make later on in the show. So anyway, it was pretty good. I was a pretty good grill man. I had her side.
So you were grilling all the marshmallows?
I was grilling all the marshmallows, and I had on chopsticks, like skewers. They were big squares, so they wouldn't stay on one skewer, so I was doing two skewers like chopsticks. Oh, by the time I got to the last one, I finally had to figure it out.
How many end up in the fire?
Yeah, exactly. None. Thank you very much. Okay. The next time a recipe calls for you to dot butter on top of a casserole, where kind of, you know, the idea is that it makes it kind of richer and...
Mm-hmm.
Try sprinkling it instead. Grate your cold butter over the large holes of a plain grater and then distribute them evenly over your dish. Much easier than trying to slice off uniform chunks by hand.
100% okay with that. I think it's a great trick of the trade. You put your butter in the freezer and you grate it on top of your dish. It will be even. I'm 100% agreeing with that.
Mm-hmm. Now,
there is nothing wrong about this explanation. It's actually all good.
We also do that in our house with butter for when you're making biscuits or scones or something, where you grate the frozen butter. And basically, you have to work fast because the smaller pieces of butter get warm faster.
Right.
But it also means you don't have to work it as much with your warm fingers.
Correct.
And so that's kind of the give.
It's the same for everything in cooking. You know, you often see cooks or people at home, when they're seasoning something, then they have a tendency to take the salt or the pepper and then be like in one place, you know. It's extremely important that you season the entire thing correctly, you know, and season evenly. So this grating of the bottle does allow to do that.
Have you ever wondered why occasionally you buy a bunch of bananas and the stems are wrapped in plastic? Well, that's because if you wrap the tops in plastic wrap or aluminum foil, they will last up to 5 days longer. I never knew that.
It's a new trend that's been showing up everywhere on the market in the last year. Mm-hmm. And you buy your bananas in bunch and the whole stem is all wrapped up.
Now, it's interesting. You know, in Europe, where I think people tend to shop day of their cooking.
Right.
They don't, you know, when we were growing up as kids, my mom went Saturday morning, she had a budget and she had a grocery list, and it was about three or four shopping carts full of food for the week.
Right.
I could see where this trick would be important then, but these days, if I feel like when I want to make dinner at home, I literally shop right before I make dinner.
I think people buy bananas for the week.
They buy bananas
really
for the week.
I believe that. Okay. And bananas will last a week. It's not a strong issue. It's just if you want to try to keep them longer, you know, you have the end wrapped up. I think it's more for the stores than they do that. So the stores can keep them on the shelf longer.
Here's one that makes me a little bit crazy, but I understand why people do it. For healthy eating, the easiest way to do so is to swap out zucchini noodles for pasta.
No, just give up the idea and go eat somewhere else.
Yeah, I know that the gluten-free people are always looking for alternatives.
Right.
I personally would stick to gluten-free pasta. There's good products in the marketplace, and I, you know, it's fun to make pasta. You can make it out of gluten-free flour. But the whole zucchini noodle thing took off with these spiralizers. My CEO, Pamela, loves her zucchini noodles. I just never got into them.
Well, it's not very strong in flavor, so you definitely, it's going to be like, but it's just like pasta. It's going to matter
strong,
of what you put with it, you know, and I mean, a little grated cheese and salted mushroom added to your zucchini is going to make a fantastic dish. Are you going to recognize when you're eating that it's a zucchini, not a pasta? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, because...
If you're going to do it, I would say either don't blanch your zucchini noodles and use them raw so they have some texture left. Because if you put something like a raw tomato sauce on it, the acids from the tomatoes will cook your noodles as much as you want them cooked. Or if you are going to blanch them first, let's say you want them hot, literally 5 seconds, 3 seconds, as little as you can, because that zucchini is just going to disintegrate. So
my recommendation is to make a pasta that's a little bit thicker and then put butters in a pan, in a sauté pan. Wait till the butter turns brown. Then drop in your zucchini, do a quick sauté twice, and then take them out. And they're done.
Yeah,
and
that was my sound effect.
And they will have a nice, beautiful, nutty flavor added to the zucchini, which, you know, you put some ground toasted hazelnut in there, and some mushroom and some cheese, and you have a wonderful dish on your hand.
Yeah, here's my favorite one for a trashy home version of something I've never had before. If you think the mayonnaise on the outside of the bread is a food hack, you know, some people put mayonnaise or butter on the outside of a bread when they're making grilled cheese or something.
Yeah.
Because mayonnaise is just oil, basically. There's a little bit of egg, but mostly oil. Just wait. Spray nonstick cooking spray in your waffle iron. Place a layer of frozen hash browns in the waffle iron. Then add your grated cheese over top of that. And then add more hash browns over top of that.
Make a sandwich
cook in your waffle iron, remove and let cool, and voila, the most decadent grilled cheese you could ever imagine.
Sounds delicious.
I think I might try that. I've never bought frozen hash browns before. Have you ever?
No.
Of course you haven't.
No. Of course I haven't. No, but I mean, making hash brown is not a brain surgery effort.
I understand, but I just have never bought
it. I'm not sure that it would work well with fresh hash brown, actually, because I think the secret of this, why it works so well, is because you're using frozen hash brown. I'm not sure it would work as well for the fresh. I think it would stick like crazy to your grill.
Yeah, I have no idea. All right, coming up, your summer cooking guide with Tom and Terry on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Hello, it's Rachel Bell. And did you know that Muckleshoot Casino is your destination for food, fun, and gaming? Well, it is. Muckleshoot Casino offers more than 3,000 gaming machines, action-packed table games, including the only iRoulette tables in the state, and hands down the best poker in the Pacific Northwest. And you can complete your experience with an amazing meal at one of their many restaurants at the largest smoke-free gaming area in the state. Muckleshoot Casino in Auburn is the biggest and best in the Northwest. Northwest. And they have air conditioning. Muckleshootcasino.com.
Hey, this is Todd Herman. You know, I recently had lunch with some of the team from Renter's Warehouse, and I was just blown away. I mean, I already knew some of the basics, that they manage over 22,000 homes across the country. They're the largest real estate investment company in America. Here's what I didn't know. Started by a founder who bought his first investment property as a young man. It was a duplex. And the company now scales for people like you or me who have a couple of different homes that we need to get rented out in a safe way, a secure way, with good tenants, good guarantees on the rent, making sure that you are only contacted if you need to be contacted, all the way up to friends of mine, people you know who've got all sorts of houses. Plus, Renter's Warehouse can help you in that climb to becoming a real estate investor. So whether it's one property or many properties, you can't find someone who does a better job than Renter's Warehouse. It's stress-free property management. Visit renterswarehouse.com. Take advantage of their free rental property analysis. That's renterswarehouse.com. List, invest, rent, all under one roof.
Guys, we all know it, but hair loss can rob you of your personal identity, your confidence, and age you. What if I told you there was a simple, affordable, one-day treatment out there? John Curley for Advanced Hair. You want the best results with the highest-rated doctors and the latest technology and a state-of-the-art facility? It starts right here in Bellevue at Advanced Hair. Check out AdvancedHair.com. And for a free consultation, call 425-449-8185. That's 425-449-8185 or AdvancedHair.com.
Hey, Brock Hewitt here with Toyota Puyallup in Cary. And what amazes me is the RAV4 has been your best seller the last 2 years. And yet, Toyota and you never sit still.
Thankfully, Toyota never sits still. They've just released an all-new 2019 RAV4 with great new styling, enhanced safety features, all-new technology, including Apple CarPlay.
And not just the new body 2019, there's a couple other versions.
That's right. They have the Adventure Series, which is more of an off-road RAV with increased torque, higher towing capacity. And the best thing is they've just announced the Hybrid, which is not last year's Hybrid. Toyota's technology now in the Hybrid is increased performance, faster speed. The RAV is all around a better vehicle.
The summer savings event on now at Toyota Puyallup. Lease 2019 RAV4 LE for just $249 a month. And with 60 to choose from, Toyota Puyallup is sure to have what you're looking for. Toyota Puyallup, putting you first since 1970. Lease on approval credit through TFS, $29.99 due at signing, $150 doc fee may be added to the final sale or capitalized cost. Details at ToyotaPuyallup.com. Expires 7/31/19.
Everything you need to upgrade your ride with the newest technology is on sale now.
At Car Toys, biggest sale of the year.
$16 million of the best brands.
Pioneer, Kenwood, Alpine, Sony, JL Audio, Kicker, Focal.
CD players from $49.
Amps from $69.
Upgrade with Pioneer Apple CarPlay. Just $249. $100 off while they last.
Beat the heat with remote start for $149. Includes installation by Car Toys experts.
Buy one Infinity speaker, get one free while they last.
Dash cameras, $19.
Subwoofers from $49.
Kenwood Stereo with Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, DVD, $250 off while they last.
Huge savings in every category.
Car Toys Summer Doorbuster event is our biggest sale of the year.
A better way to go.
Hey, here's a new Doorbuster. Add music streaming and hands-free calling with a touchscreen Pioneer Multimedia Stereo. Just $89 while they last.
Cam for Bath Fitter.
Bath Fitter prides itself on a one-day bath remodel. One thing that's very important at Bath Fitter is paying attention to the detail. At Bath Fitter, we manufacture our own product. We make it, we measure it, and we install it, and we offer you a lifetime warranty. We believe in building value and trust with our customer to provide choices and a solution for something that they may like and be happy with forever.
For a limited time, save $500 off your total installation. Call 800-NEW-BATH.
It's Tom and Terry. We're smack dab in the middle of summer. Mr. Rotro,
this
is a fun season to be a chef in.
I love to be a chef in the summer and in the fall, too.
Yeah. There's so much bounty in our state, it's easy to get overwhelmed. I've talked often recently about walking into the produce departments of our local grocery stores and just getting that big grin on my face when you look at it.
I spend a lot more money right now than I do the rest of the year, for sure.
I know. Yeah, exactly. And I do a lot of IQFing right now that I use for the rest of the summer, which is you take a pint of the berries, you put them out on one of your cookie sheets, put the cookie sheet into the freezer. They all freeze individually. So it's individually quick frozen and then pop them into a Ziploc or something. And I like to put a little paper towel in there, too, in the Ziploc, because it seems to soak up frost.
And also the odors that comes with freezing and all that stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, so it's IQF time. It's time to get gooseberries and currants and raspberries and marionberries and blackberries and strawberries and then, you know, quickly heading into apricots and blueberries. And
I have Skagit Valley strawberry frozen, and I have raspberry, a lot of beautiful raspberries frozen already. So,
all right. So, as you know, I was born in this country, so I am forced to eat corn off the cob.
Oh, yeah.
You, on the other hand, from France, probably didn't eat much corn off the cob.
Never.
Never.
Never did I
eat. Explain that to why that is to people that are listening who might say, well,
so corn
they
on
not,
the, corn,
may, might not know that.
Corn on the cob is an American tradition of raising corn to eat as humans. There is two different kinds of corn. There is a corn for the animals and there is a corn for the human.
Mm-hmm.
And in France, we don't grow corn for the humans. It's starting now. Some people are starting a little bit because of the American influence. But when I was a kid, there's no way in the world. And even after 10 years I was in the United States, I would tell them, oh, I just had some corn. And they'd be like, why do you eat corn? That's for the cows. They would not.
So you didn't even have corn that you would, like cream corn that you would cut off the cob? You
no.
just never had corn on your table?
Never had corn, period.
On your home
that
table?
That was not part of the food
interesting.
Chain. No.
I corn. Just thought it was not off the cob.
No. Just okay. never. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I came to America, and then, of course, at the beginning, I'm like, well, these people are eating corn. What's wrong with these people? Don't they have other food to eat?
They're very poor people.
I'm like, what, are they going to eat grass next? What's going on? Anyway, I learned to, you know, I was introduced to it, and I loved it. And, I mean, I just think a corn on the cob, especially this time of the year,
mm-hmm.
a beautiful white corn on the cob. You know,
what do you like to put on it?
You know, I'm a big fan of just extra virgin olive oil, salt and pepper, uh-huh. and that's it.
Yeah.
I don't even put butter on my corn. I just put extra virgin olive oil a little bit, and that's it. I love the flavor of a corn that just got cooked and not very long. You know, I'm not a big fan of cooking it for long. If I'm going to blanch it in water, it's going to be like 4 minutes max.
Yeah.
If I'm going to put it on the grill, it's going to be wrapped up in aluminum foil. Again, I'm going to put a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, wrapped in aluminum foil. I'm not trying to grill the corn.
Right.
I'm trying to just cook it.
Yeah.
And in that foil, it's going to cook for about 5-6 minutes, and it's done. And that's the way I like my corn.
I like to put it right on the grill.
Right. No, I've done
caramelized.
That too. I've done that too.
Then I make a little. I put a pan on the stove or on the grill. Put in my little chunk of butter.
Mm-hmm.
Put in about a tablespoon of molasses, both for color and for sweetness. And then, of course, I have unsalted butter at home, so I use my smoked Alderwood smoked salt.
Uh-huh.
And then I use a little bit of my smoked paprika. Put it in all into that butter, and then I brush it onto my corn.
Oh, nice.
And it is...
why do you put molasses? I mean, corn is already so
It's already sweet.
Sweet,
but when you're grilling it with the butter on it helps caramelize just a little bit. You don't want to use a lot.
Right.
And it makes a beautiful golden color. So.
Cool.
All right, grilling shrimp. A few easy steps for me. Either you have one of those perforated wok pans that mm-hmm. fits over a fire, because I think shrimp are really hard to grill without either being on skewers or in a pan like that.
Right.
And then they really take very little time. You know, as we talked earlier in the show about eggs continuing to cook, so mm-hmm. do shrimp and scallops and
right.
little individual proteins like that cook super fast. So
I'm a big fan of going to Little Vietnam of where Viet Hoa, you know, in that area, and get it fresh off the tank, live.
Uh-huh.
Bring them home, just throw in salt and pepper on them, keep them in the bowl for about 30 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and then throw them whole on the grill. Now, when you put shrimp whole on the grill, it's really, really delicious because you can actually afford to have a little bit of a flame grilling mm-hmm. onto the shell.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to affect the meat, but it gives it that beautiful flavor. And
yeah.
then throw that in a big platter with just a little bit of salt on top. And put that into a platter and have people just pick at it.
The only thing I would say about that is you have to go very lightly on your oil, or you create create a soot bomb, which you don't want.
Right.
All right, watermelon or blackberries? Considering the wild blackberries are everywhere right now, they're just they have flowered and are starting to produce fruit. Watermelons, ours are still just about. They're not even. You know, they're about egg size or
right.
maybe a little bit larger
not
at
really
our
yet.
Farm right now, yeah.
But watermelon with feta cheese and a little basil, olive oil, salt, pepper makes a great salad. Blackberry, I love to cook blackberry. I'm a big fan of making it into a chutney to go on like a roast pork or something of that nature, you know, something I'm going to put on the grill to have a nice blackberry chutney. So red onion, sweat them down, blackberry, vinegar, little olive oil, finish the whole thing together and cook it slowly. And then, you know, just when the compote is all ready, putting some fresh herb, tarragon, a little tarragon in there, and then use that as a component to put on top of meat or fish or whatever you want. Salmon goes well with that, too.
You know, I tried the other day. I tried to, this is where, even though you've been cooking for a million years, you still screw up sometimes. Mm-hmm. I did a little smoked duck appetizer off the grill, just low and slow, smoked duck, got a nice crisp.
Right.
And then I skewered it as a little slice with a fresh raspberry. You know, just thinking fruit and duck, blah, blah, blah. That raspberry was so strong, I couldn't even taste my duck that I worked for hours on, and the raspberry, which I just popped on a skewer, it just overwhelmed the duck. It was interesting to me.
Probably because the acid was so high, it was not very
and
ripe.
It was very ripe, and the fruit flavor was so strong that I couldn't taste the duck. And so the lesson learned was, take those very same raspberries, and you do what you just said, or you break them down in a way, maybe 50% raspberries, 50% red wine, and some black pepper, and you make a little glaze, and you brush a little bit of the raspberry onto that smoked duck. It would have been perfect. But you know, it's just funny. You know, it just didn't even occur to me. I was thinking, a fresh raspberry, a nice smoky duck.
That's why those combinations are very important, but they're also very important to know how to use the acids and the fruit and all that stuff in the component.
Would you have guessed, though, that one raspberry would have overwhelmed a five-hour roasted duck?
No. No, absolutely
on a wood fire?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it's just funny little things that happen. Yep. All right, apricots are here. One of my favorite things about cooking apricots is that they turn sour when you cook them, right?
I love that.
That was a revelation 30 years ago when I first, what the heck is going on here? And I was making these little lamb kind of force meat into my apricots and then baking them. And then all of a sudden, it's like, where's my sweetness? It's all gone. And that's an interesting phenomenon about apricots.
Yeah. They definitely have a very, very strong acid flavor. The after when you eat those cooked apricot, what's your left in your mouth is definitely tangy and super, super strong on acid. Mm-hmm. So you have to think of mixing that with something else and make sure that the component you're going to marry it with is definitely balanced and neutral, because otherwise you're not going to be able to taste it.
What's your favorite summertime blueberry dish?
Well,
you only have a minute.
The famous salad I stole from you, the corn and blueberry salad, raw corn. Take off the kernel off the cob, mix it with some blueberry, diced white onion, a little basil, rice vinegar, olive oil. Make the whole thing macerated on the counter for about an hour, and you get the most beautiful. And by the way, we serve that at Bastille Day every year.
Oh, do you?
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful
people
summertime
love
salad.
It.
Yeah.
Blueberry and corn salad.
Lovely. All right. I took a minute and went over to check in on Brittany Bartolaven over at the Dahlia Bakery and learned how to make the best s'mores in the world. For some more of that talk on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Stay with us. Hey, it's Tom Douglas. It's the Seattle Kitchen, and it's time for the Baker's Corner. Hey, it's Chef Tom Douglas. I'm in Brittany Bartolaven's kitchen, where we're taping the Baker's Corner this week because she's busy making s'more packs for the Dahlia Bakery. Today, we're going to dedicate this entire segment to the best s'more I ever had. And which is funny about this, because it's two s'mores. One is a little bit more traditional. It's a s'more kind of chocolate chip cookie. But it's a little bit more traditional even than the s'more with the graham cracker, marshmallow, and chocolate bar. So Brittany Bartolaven is going to tell us about her s'more. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but last week we had Robin Wheel Martin from Hello Robin Cookies. And she was at summer camp and made delicious s'more chocolate chip cookies. What I loved about her chocolate chip cookies was that, or her s'more cookies, was that she put the chopped up marshmallows kind of into the cookie batter and cooked them, and they kind of boiled out and caramelized around the cookie. And then when the cookie was perfectly done, she pulled them out of the oven and put the chocolate chunk on top of the super hot cookie. So it kind of just melted into the cookie. But I liked it because you got the caramelization on the marshmallow, and that's what's usually missing when someone tries to do a s'more cookie, is you don't get that crusty marshmallow like you do when you put one over the fire. Now, Chef.
Yes.
Your s'more, you and I made on Fifth Avenue with all the traffic going by. We were out on the sidewalk, all the traffic going by, and I was your grill man, and you made a s'more which is more traditional in that it had the graham cracker, the chocolate, and the marshmallow,
But it was so crazy and crazy delicious at the same time. So let's go through how you made a wild s'more right on Fifth Avenue in downtown Seattle.
That was super fun. Thank you for being my grill man, by the way. I would have gone down in flames without you. Let's start with the marshmallow, which I think is the most important piece. A homemade marshmallow is so easy. Very few ingredients, sugar and corn syrup, salt, vanilla, and gelatin. There's no egg whites in this marshmallow. And you see a lot of recipes for s'mores that have egg whites in them, and that gives them structure and makes them firm. It makes for a nice just eating marshmallow. But if you're going to toast that marshmallow, you want it to collapse, just like the Jet Puff marshmallows. And so you want to omit the egg whites for that. So you're just going to cook your sugar and your corn syrup and your salt to soft ball, which I believe is 236.
If you don't know, how are we going to know?
And then pour that over your gelatin and whip it. And that it aerates the marshmallow. It makes it really lofty and fluffy. And that's it. And so from that canvas, you can...
So you take your you make a hot sugar syrup to 230 and do what to it?
You add it to your gelatin,
okay,
and then whip it in the standing mixer. Okay. And it gets really, really gloopy and messy, but that's kind of what's fun about it. So you've got this blank canvas that you can then add fennel pollen to. You've had my fennel pollen marshmallows. This time I was using the anise hyssop that I'm obsessed with from Prosser Farm. So you can add spices, you can add vanilla beans, whatever you want. So for the anise hyssop marshmallow, I took my anise hyssop leaves and then added it to my pot of sugar and just cooked it the whole time with that sugar and then strained it over my gelatin. So I strained out the leaves before I whipped it, and it just perfumed this marshmallow. So since I had this anise hyssop flavored marshmallow, I then wanted to pair it with the root beer chocolate.
I'm not going to let you
All right.
Okay, so you got this big mixer bowl full of this marshmallow fluff, basically.
Yes.
So what happens from that?
You glove up because it's still pretty hot. And I usually spray my gloves and every tool that I'm using with like a pan spray. In the kitchen, we use Vegeline Pam or something commercially available would be fine too, because it's so sticky. I mean, you're going to get it everywhere. You're going to get it on your elbow, your hair, everything. But you want to work quickly, because from there it starts to set up a bit, and you just scrape it into a hotel pan or a tray or a cookie sheet, exactly, and let it set up overnight. And the next day you're going to cut it. Now, when I do that, I spray my knife with that pan spray as well so that it makes a nice clean cut. And then have you ever noticed on the grocery store the marshmallows have this sort of powder? Yeah, so that is a mixture of equal parts powdered sugar and potato starch. At home, corn starch will work just as fine. And so you're then going to toss your cut marshmallow in that powder, shake it off a little bit, and that's what keeps it from sticking together if you're, you know.
That's how they stay separate.
That's how they stay separate.
By the way, we're in the kitchen right here. We're in Brittany's kitchen as we talk about these s'mores that are so fantastic. So. That's why it sounds like it does.
Yes, a little loud in here, but I'm in my element.
So. Okay, so now the graham cracker.
The graham cracker. You don't have to use graham flour to make a graham cracker. I actually don't really like graham flour all that much. So for my graham cracker, Tom's got a piece right in front of him now. Tastes like a graham cracker, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the honey and the molasses that gives it that flavor, not the graham flour. So you don't need to seek out graham flour, which, by the way, is fairly easy to find. I believe Bob's Red Mill makes a graham flour. Yeah. I use mostly all-purpose flour and then a bit of the Fairhaven coarse rye flour, which gives it a little bit of a nubby, nice texture to it. You don't have to use a graham cracker at all. You don't even have to use that flavor, but you do want your cookie to have some baking soda in it, and you want the fat to be cut into it pie dough style. And when I say that, I mean you're not creaming your softened butter with sugar. You're cutting it into the flour, cold cubes of butter. You can use a chocolate chip cookie or a shortbread cookie, but to me, you want a light. I like that light, crisp texture that a graham cracker has.
And they're super crisp. Is that a sugar content, or what makes them that crisp, or the lack of creaming?
It's the lack of creaming in that baking soda. So it's kind of like a pie dough, but yes, you're right, Tom. The molasses and the honey adds to that crispness as well, but it's also light. It doesn't break your tooth. You want it to, when you bite into it, have some give to it.
All right, there's a lot of genius going on in this s'more, which, you know, the crispy graham cracker, which doesn't have any graham, the homemade anise hyssop marshmallow, which has a bit of a, I think of anise hyssop being kind of a mix between fennel and tarragon, maybe, or something like that. But then you had the wild card, which is a Theo chocolate. By the way, I have stock in Theo chocolate. Thank you for using that. But it's the Theo chocolate root beer chocolate bar. So what is that?
It's a 55% chocolate, so it's not. It's kind of somewhere in between milk chocolate and dark chocolate, which I'll talk about that in a minute. And then they just took those actual root beer barrel candies and crushed them up and stirred it into the chocolate and then tempered it. And so when you bite into it, you've got these lovely, crispy little bits of root beer. And you really, the flavor really permeates into the chocolate. Mm-hmm. So with the licorice-y anise hyssop marshmallow, the root beer chocolate, and then that graham, to me, it's like a little root beer float flavor going on in your s'more, which...
I love the little crunch that you get out of the candy bar along with everything else. It's like, what's going on in my mouth right now?
Exactly. So, yeah. That's my favorite thing to have people ask when they eat my desserts. And Theo's has a really cool line of interesting chocolates. I would not suggest a milk chocolate in a s'more because it's too sweet. I also wouldn't suggest a super deep dark chocolate because it's overpowering, too robust. For me, somewhere in the 50 to 60% cocoa. It's perfect. But they do make a lemon milk chocolate that paired beautifully with the fennel pollen marshmallows. So that made a really neat s'more. Yeah.
So now you're selling these s'more kits at the Dahlia Bakery. Do they sell? Do people? Because they have to be a little expensive, I would think.
Well, we put them on the shelves today, so I will let you know. The marshmallows have been a really great seller, but we just started doing these s'more kits. But really, I just can't think of an easier dessert if you're entertaining. If you got your grill on, you and I discovered that it works great on just a Weber grill. Because everything can be done in advance, and you can take some help from Theo Chocolate or any other nice chocolate bar that you like, but Theo's my favorite, so... it's a great entertaining dessert, and you get everyone around the grill, and...
That's the thing that I think is super cool. Yeah. Like, your marshmallows are so big that I had to put two skewers through them, or else they would just drop off. So I was kind of like, I felt like a little marionette master, because you kind of have the two skewers, one in each hand, and you're kind of working the marshmallow around, because I wanted to get all four sides, the two small sides and the two big sides, because it was a square marshmallow. I wanted to get all four sides toasted evenly before I popped it onto that root beer chocolate bar. And it was interesting because there were so many people lined up waiting for marshmallows. It's like, okay, do you like it crusty? Do you like it charbroiled? Like, some people love to get their marshmallows caught on fire.
Like me. Yeah,
do you like that? Yeah.
Too, yeah.
Yeah. So that's part is I literally felt like literally your grill man, like a marionette master.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I loved it. One thing I'm going to say about a s'more is check your dignity at the door when you eat it. It's not a tidy dessert, and it shouldn't be. The messier, the better. You're supposed to have fun with this, so and serve it with plenty of wet naps.
Okay, just to end up on this thing, I took home a cake the other night from the Dahlia Bakery because I like to cheat sometimes, and I was having people over for dinner, my new in-laws, or new my new... What's the your daughter's in-laws?
I guess that's your in-laws. You're yeah, in-laws. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Anyway, they were coming over, so I had to run and get to the Dahlia Bakery, and I had this pistachio cake with apricots on top.
Yeah.
It was so good.
Thank you.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was the first time I've had that. All right, this has been the Baker's Corner with Chef Brittany Bartolaban on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Thank you.
All right, we are back in the Seattle kitchen. It's time for tasty trivia, food for thought, right here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Gary Rotirol, the chef in a hat.
And we have a young lady in our midst who is a listener to the show.
Making us nervous.
We are both making each other nervous because we always get clanged.
You nervous.
we always get clanged by these people who, they're scared to come on. They don't know anything about food, blah, blah, blah. Nonsense. Everyone knows something about food. But anyway, Sandy is here. She works in this building and is a listener to our show. And Sandy, you are... up to the challenge. Your arms are folded. You are intense. You're ready to go. Here's the thing. There's not even an audience to give you any hints today.
I know. This is like...
So that's kind of sad. But we're confident that you can do it.
Okay. I will give it my best shot.
All right. Tina, you want to take us through the rules?
I most certainly do. Here's how the game is played. Each of you will get 5 questions. Whoever gets the most correct is obviously the winner. Whoever gets the least amount of answers correct is the loser. And that loser has to give something away to one of our listeners. Today you're playing for Daryl Ray. Daryl asked the question about pots and pans and things that would last a while in the kitchen. It prompted a very good conversation earlier in the show. If you missed that, you can grab it via podcast. Just search for Seattle Kitchen wherever you listen to podcasts. As your producer, I just always have to, you know, let everybody know all the different ways to get the show.
You do better than we do.
All right. Chef in the hat.
Yes.
Chef Thierry, if you lose today, what will you give to Daryl?
I think I'm going to send him to brunch at Luke in Madison Valley on a Saturday or Sunday. Brunch for two.
All right. Sandy, we forgot to tell you. when you play the food quiz, if you lose the quiz, you have to give something away.
Well, since Sandy is just right here in the building, she's not going to be able to do that. So I am going to let Sandy pick anything from our places that place of ours that she likes to go to and give that away. So what would that be, Sandy?
I love the crab sandwiches at Seatown.
At Seatown, down there in the Pike Place Market area. Perfect. All right. So not only will our listener, Daryl, get two seats at Seatown, say $75 value, but I'm going to give you two seats also, Sandy, if you win.
Ooh.
So that's $150. Yay. You're playing for $75 for you and $75 for Daryl.
Wow. High stakes.
That is big day.
Cool. High stakes here at Seattle Kitchen. Chef Tom Douglas, should you lose, what will you give away?
I will give away dinner for two at the Palace Kitchen. Open till 1 o'clock in the morning every night for dinner.
Nice.
For the last 25 years? How many?
26
years?
Now.
26.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. So no matter what, Daryl will be the winner today.
Yeah.
Chef Thierry, would you like to go first?
Yes, please.
All right. Your first question. What falling fruit supposedly inspired Isaac Newton to write the laws of gravity?
That would be the apple.
Correct. What method of preserving food did the Incas first use on potatoes?
I would say salt curing.
No, the answer is
I'd
actually
say potato salad.
Yeah, potato salad. The Incas were the first to make potato salad. Yeah. Who knew? No, the answer is freeze drying.
Freeze drying.
Yeah. Wow. Right. Chef, what hit the market alongside spinach as the first frozen veggies?
Peas.
Correct. Question number four for you. What sticky sweetener was traditionally used as an antiseptic ointment for cuts and bruises?
Honey.
Ooh, you're on it.
Yes. You are on it.
I know honey is good for antiseptic.
That's 3 out of 4 correct. Question number 5 for you, Chef. Sourness is caused by the taste of what?
Oh, some enzyme. Maybe that's the answer.
Nope. Not the answer.
Baba says a sheep. Okay, what's the answer?
I prefer baba rums.
What's the answer?
Do you know?
Acid.
Correct. The answer is acid. But that was a great, valiant showing. 3 out of 4 correct for you today. All right, Sandy, you're up.
Oh, boy.
Miss Sandy, about what percent of children have a food allergy? You have some options. Is it 50, 20, or 8%? What percentage of children have a food allergy?
I'm going with 8.
Correct. Nicely done.
Nice.
Miss Sandy, question number 2. What nut do 2/3 of its U.S. producers sell through Blue Diamond?
Almonds.
Yes.
Correct. 2 out of 2.
She doesn't know anything, but so far she's 2 out of 2.
We've seen this game before.
Miss Sandy, question number 3. What's the ground nut better known as?
Peanut.
Correct.
Oh, she pulled that out of her hat.
All right, question number 4. What's the only fish that produces real caviar according to the FDA?
Sturgeon.
That's 4 out of 4 so
She's
far.
What is going
four.
On here?
I'm already bitten.
For a perfect score, how many sizes of chicken eggs does the USDA recognize, including peewee?
Let's go 5. I probably missed one.
That's not how many you counted on your fingers,
though.
Yeah,
you counted more.
I did?
How many did you just count on?
Peewee, large, extra large, jumbo, small. Did I get medium? That makes 6.
6 is
You're
the
helping
answer.
Me.
5 out of 5, Tom.
That's a perfect.
That is just not right.
Score.
There's something.
I was trying to be nice.
I know.
And then boom.
I should have 5
right back
out of
at
5,
me.
Sandy. You still scared?
Always.
No, look at her. Arms are unfolded. She's relaxed in her chair.
Oh, that's beautiful showing.
5 is the number to beat. Or tie.
Okay, Tom.
Chef Tom Douglas. All right, question number 1.
She just said, bring it on.
What company first condensed soup in 1898?
Campbell's.
Correct. What newly imported substance caused the first major outbreak of tooth decay in Europe in the 1500s?
Sugar.
Correct. Chef, question number three for you. What are deheaded, deveined, and sorted by size in a latrum machine?
Shrimp.
Correct. Wow, three out of three. I got to find something harder for you. Question number four for you. What type of chocolate was first developed for public consumption in Vevey, Switzerland in 1875?
Milk chocolate.
Correct. Oh, it's four out of four.
Wow. Don't act so depressed about that.
You need one more to tie with Sandy. What crystalline salt is frequently used to enhance the flavor to TV dinners? Nice face. Tom's looking at me like, really, Tina?
Crystalline. La baleine.
Salt for TV dinners? Only in TV dinners?
Crystalline salt is frequently used to enhance the flavor to TV dinners, among other things.
MSG.
There you go.
Motto sodium.
Do TV dinners really have MSG in them?
Everything has MSG.
Really? I'm surprised at that.
Hmm. Looks like he's going to Luke.
Yes, it looks like Daryl is going to enjoy a wonderful meal at Luke.
Congratulations, Sandy, for getting a perfect score.
I know. Unbelievable.
Congratulations to you, Terry, for losing and having to give brunch to Daryl at Luke. He'll enjoy it immensely. If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter. Just search for Seattle Kitchen. Our show is produced by the folks here at Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. Our sound engineer is Sean, Don't Call Me Del Torre. If you'd like to become part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. Comes with breakfast and hot coffee. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to Stitcher or iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Just search for Seattle Kitchen. And I want to thank you for listening.